People should be able to hear me with this. It's, I'm like giving myself a headache already. Okay. I have a little bit of a sore throat, but I think I can project enough. So if you can't hear me, speak out, number one. Number two is if you have a question as we go along, raise your hand, you know, and let me, we'll stop and we'll talk about things. So this is a very basic overview of oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes. Again, it's not going to be ultimate detail, but I think you're going to get a good taste for how these things were discovered, what they mean, how they relate to human cancers. Okay? So definitions, oncogenes. We're going to have some definitions, how do oncogenes function in cancer cells. I'm hearing like feedback. Can you hear that? Okay, it's too loud. How are oncogenes turned on? Tumor suppressor genes, what are they? How do they function? And how is their function lost in cancer cells? Hopefully we'll hit every single one of those. Oh, sorry. I apologize in advance. So the copies that you got that Anand printed out, I gave him that copy of the lecture a little bit earlier. I actually found some things that needed some sprucing up. So the lecture that I'm going to give, which just has a couple extra slides, a little bit more explanation, will be on the UB Learns site, right? Anand, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So whatever you don't see in your notes, it's going to be in the one that was uploaded to UB Learns. Okay? Thanks. All right. So this is, by now, all of you should know this in the cancer field. This was, so Hanahan and Weinberg, every 5 years or something like that, come out with a new review paper, typically in Cell, and they call it Hallmarks of Cancer, and they add to new components of what a cancer cell is doing that defeats or has dysfunction to some normal process. So, for example, all right, we're under attack. It's the Canadians, I think. All right, I have no idea what that is. There you go. All right, let's see. No idea. All right, so for example, sustained proliferative signaling. Let me make sure that's not my phone. Hold on, just 1 second. No, that's off. Okay, all off. So normal cells, all cells have a cell cycle, which you should know about. Different parts of the cell cycle, including replicating the cell's DNA. So then you end up having daughter cells, two cells from one original cell. And the controls about the pace of proliferation, whether the cell is going to proliferate under these conditions or those conditions, or not proliferate at all, in other words, it may be terminally differentiated, all those things are defined in quote-unquote normal cells, and cancer cells have defeated that. So, again, things like growth suppressors have been evaded, and you can go through every single one of these things. These lead to, these are the processes that cancer cells overcome in order to give you a cancer cell. What was added in the 2011 Hallmarks of Cancer is this picture in the middle, which shows the complicated interaction of tumor cells with the so-called microenvironment, including vasculature, stromal cells, macrophages, immune cells, all these other things, and to show that there's a very complicated dance between these two sets of cells in order to really allow tumors to progress and then to become malignant, including things like metastasis and so on. So when we start to talk about oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes, we have to fit them into every single one of these biologies. I'm not going to go over every single one of them. I'll go over a handful, but understand that all these genes in some way either hit every single one of these biologies or some specific biologies. Okay, so let's go to the definitions. Again, these are general definitions. So oncogenes, they promote some of these oncogenic growth parameters, as I just mentioned, for example, cell proliferation, immortalization, survival, cell motility, invasiveness, angiogenesis, ultimately starting a tumor, maintaining the tumor growth, and leading to malignancy. Usually oncogenes are upregulated, that is to say, more RNA and or protein. Gene amplification, which of course if you have more genes, usually that means more RNA and more protein, or mutated, and we'll discuss how they could be mutated in order to make these genes oncogenic. Tumor suppressors, they're simply working on the other side. So this is the yin and yang. They normally suppress all the aforesaid functions. And they are typically downregulated, so less RNA or protein deleted, the genes are gone, or again, they're mutated, but in this case, the mutations are deleterious to their function. All right, so oncogene was coined by Huebner and Todaro, this is in the late 60s, and with the notion that they have the potential to cause cancer. So we'll get to this notion of what a proto-oncogene is, but those of you who know Greek know that proto is before. So how can you have something that's before an oncogene? We'll talk about that a little bit more. And they will transform it. That word actually came about in the 1960s, that you had these healthy or so-called normal cells, and now they've been transformed oncogenically so that they look and act like cancer cells. These genes were first discovered in retroviruses, in viruses. Later, the versions of these genes, the proto-oncogenes and mutated versions of those, were found in cells in all sorts of mammalian species. Again, we'll expand on that. All right, so a little bit of a historical trip. So the first description of, so at the turn of the 20th century, early 1900s, there was a flurry of activity by early microbiologists. Microbiologists were the big heroes of medicine at the time. You had, it was, you know, maybe a couple of decades since Pasteur and Koch and Ehrlich, the very, very famous microbiologists. And it was, at that point, fairly well accepted that these little microbes that you could see in microscopes were causing disease in us, in you know, big beings like us, like people. Prior to the 1880s, this theory was laughed at generally in the proceedings of European medicine, which were really the biggest ones in the world at the time. So it was a big shift in order to accept the microbial cause of disease. Viruses had not been even described. But here's a case of Peyton Rouse, who was a student of Paul Ehrlich, who was a colleague of Pasteur. So an early microbiologist working at what was then called Rockefeller Institute on the east side of New York City, if anybody knows that. And it was a small institute. And so a chicken farmer in Long Island, because at the time Long Island was basically one large farm, had been noticing that a flock of his chickens were developing these solid tumors. And anyone who's worked with chickens, and I have, know that they're not very smart animals, and they basically peck at everything. They actually don't know what is food and what is not food. They peck at everything. And they especially peck at their colleagues who have some sort of lesion. They just peck at things. So it was this farmer noticed that when they would peck at the wing web of a chicken that had a tumor, and then they would peck at each other, where they pecked at each other, another tumor would form.
No idea.
Oh, okay. That person was eventually led to Peyton Rouse, and that story that I just told you sounds like an infectious root. Right, so the chickens are giving it one to the other by this pecking mechanism. So this was some early information. So Peyton Rouse said, oh, it's got to be a bacteria, because that's what they knew about. They used to have, at the time, types of filters. You don't have to write this down, called a Zeiss filter. So in order to sterilize things, you could autoclave them, that's high heat, under pressure, or you could filter them. And a Zeiss filter was really revolutionary at the time because it was compressed coral, compressed so hard that the only things that could, actually bacteria could not even get through. So if you wanted to sterilize something, and by the way, anybody who's been in a laboratory, we have the grandchild of that thing, you know, these big filters with the membrane, and then, you know, you could have a suction. And so now you put something in, and whatever gets sucked through is now sterile. So what he expected, because there were rules of microbiology, which stated that something that was a microbe that caused the disease had to be identified from a lysate of the disease, a tumor, for example, in this case. You had to then inject it into another animal and get the same lesion, a tumor. And then from that animal, you had to also extract it, inject it a third time, and then still get a tumor. All right? And one of the ways that you'd be able to show that it was a bacteria was, of course, if you put it through the Zeiss filter, it should be stopped. It should not go through the filter. Guess what? Something that went through the filter, the filtrate, which was the control, actually was the thing that caused the transfer of the tumor to the naive chicken. So before the word virus was even coined, and this paper was published in 1911. And so basically the first description of a virus in medical literature is actually a virus associated with cancer. But at the time it was not called a virus, it was called a filterable agent. And it wasn't called a virus for another decade. Okay? So just keep that in mind. And what you can see here, probably look at this a little bit better, is that if you have a monolayer, and this is a petri dish, actually a tissue culture dish, with chicken embryo fibroblasts that would make a monolayer. So this is by our eye, it's not a microscope. But if you let this grow, you infected it with some of the filtrate, you would see all these bumps. Lots of bumps. And if you looked at them microscopically, these are cells growing on top of each other. And as we'll talk about in a second, one of the facets of normal cell growth, no matter what type of cell it is that they become, when they touch each other, when they get to confluence, they stop growing. Contact inhibition. So normal cells, when they grow, touch each other, they make a monolayer, stop growing. If they are now oncogenically transformed, they grow one on top of each other, it looks like a little tumor in the dish. So that was the first incidence to describe this filterable agent, then called the virus, with something that was causing cancer both in the chicken and in cell culture. And here are different versions just of different strains of Rauch sarcoma virus. It was then named after this guy, Peyton Rauch, got the Nobel Prize in the 1960s, 50 years after he first published his paper. And here are different strains of Rauch sarcoma virus, and you can see the different types of transformation that they do. Here's your monolayer of cells, which stop growing in the monolayer, and here's a little focus. Here's things, cells growing on top of each other more. Here are cells rounded up a little bit, and here are versions that really give you rounded up cells that, you know, really look tumorous, okay? This caused an explosion of research, especially in the 1960s, where people were finding more and more of these types of viruses from chickens and other animals, and they all ended up being in retroviruses. The description of them being retroviruses did not really come until the early 1970s, but what was apparent, even in this early time, is that there were two groups of these viruses associated with cancer. There were the acute disease-causing viruses and the non-acute disease-causing viruses. So let's start with those. The latter, you would inject them, and they would cause, here one would cause a lymphoma, B-cell lymphoma, but this would take months. Here's an osteopetrosis. Osteopetrosis is when it's actually when the bones become very stiff. So Again, here's 4 or 5 months, and you know, take to induce this. Whereas the acute disease-causing retroviruses, rhabdomyosarcomavirus was one of them, would be doing this in weeks. All right, here's 1 month, and again, you're at a fraction of a month. And avian erythromelanoma leukemia virus, so AEV. So two groups of viruses. Why were they different? And what became apparent, and this is even before DNA sequencing was invented, actually quite a long time beforehand, but you could do old-fashioned genetics by crossing one virus with the other and then seeing what functions were there. A lot of this came from the bacterial virus world that really flourished in the 1930s and 40s. So they used the same techniques, still a little bit more difficult, but eventually what they figured out is that the backbone of a retrovirus, these non-acute viruses, had a minimum of 3 open reading frame genes. One was called GAG, or group-specific antigen, right, AGN antigen, POL as in polymerase, and ENV as in envelope, okay? So in order for any of these viruses to replicate in permissive cells in the dish, they needed to have these minimal 3 genes. Okay, so that's that. But then, the acute viruses had sometimes GAG and just POL, and then they had an extra piece of DNA that was not any of these 3. Or they would have part of ENV or all of ENV, and then again, different genes in here. Alright? And so, they were already different. Something different compared to these guys. And what became apparent, and here, for example, this is the, again, you don't have to write this down, this would be the Schmidt-Rubin strain of rhabdomyosarcomavirus. It actually had GAG, POL, ENV complete genes, and then the whole extra gene, which in the beginning was called X, right? And experiments were done. So in the beginning, when they could do gene splicing and so on, they could take out this gene X and show that the virus could still replicate. So if the virus could still replicate, that meant that GAG, POL, and ENV were the minimal genes required for replication. Of course, if you deleted one of those 3, you didn't get replication. But when you got rid of this gene, this X, you did not get those transformation foci that I showed you the pictures of where the cells would round up and grow on top of each other. So you needed this gene in order to get oncogenic transformation, hence the name oncogene. And in the beginning, the names for those oncogenes were, these extra genes, were really, the convention was 3-letter words that would be acronyms of the virus they came from. So avian myoblastosis virus, so this is MIB myoblastosis. Fujinami sarcoma virus is FIPS. I still haven't figured out where the P comes from, but it's FIPS. Rhabdomyosarcoma virus was actually because they were inducing sarcomas, so SARC. It's not here, but RAS oncogene that everybody knows about was for Rajiv sarcoma virus. So that was the nomenclature at the time. The MIC was from a myelocytoma virus. So that's where these names came from. All right, so now we have these extra genes, and if you take them out of the virus, especially the virus had all 3 of the replication proteins, the virus still replicated, but no transformation. And then later, what people started to do is, when they got the techniques, they were able to take these individual extra genes, put them into cells, and those were sufficient to give you oncogenic transformation. Therefore, they really were oncogenes. So let's talk about SARC. SARC was the prototypic oncogene. It was really the first one that was described in happened to be a rhabdomyosarcoma virus. That was the chicken virus that I described to you from Long Island. So what was found, so here is if you look at the sequence of SARC that came from the virus, it's called V-SARC. That's what it looks like. And what became apparent is a pair working in San Francisco, Bishop and Barnes, figured out that, again, this is a chicken virus, not a coronavirus. So they started to look at the chicken genome. At the time, DNA and RNA blotting were very, very popular. So there were the techniques called Southern blotting. It was named after a guy named Southern, who was from England. Northern blotting was a joke because there was no such person as Northern. It was just RNA, so they go, let's call it another thing called Northern, and then protein called Western. They went crazy. Far Eastern blots, they, you know, there were actually Near Eastern blots. It was a little bit too crazy. But they were doing Southern blots on DNA, of chicken DNA, and lo and behold, when they used the probe that was the viral SART gene, they found a gene, they found, you know, fragments of the chicken genome that had very strong homology to that viral SART. Long story short is when they were able to sequence that, which was the early 70s, where they had to do what had come out, which was Maxim Gilbert sequencing, that was chemical sequencing, or Sanger sequencing, which was enzymatic sequencing. These are the early sequencing reactions. Really lots of work. You could probably do a couple hundred bases at a time. Lots of work. I did many of those gels. Lot of work. They figured out that here was a gene that had perfect homology when you looked at the blue exons compared to the what was the cDNA of SART. And so the origin of the SART gene was actually the chicken itself. So let's compare what C-SART, which is cellular SART, looks like compared to viral SART, V-SART. It's basically the same, except for a couple things. So depending on the strain of Russell coronavirus, you can have, where you see these stars, you can have individual point mutations. And the other thing is you always typically had a truncation of the C-terminus, and you lost this tyrosine 527. We'll get to that in a second. What Bishop and Varmus showed was even a single one of those point mutations in C-SARC was able to increase its oncogenic potential. Okay? A single mutation that we know about in V-SARC, if you put that in C-SARC, now you've got a little bit more oncogenic potential. So that started with the assumption that C-SARC itself, if you put it into the cell, it wouldn't cause oncogenic transformation. Of course, it came from the cell, so it's a normal gene. You can put in 50-fold more C-SARC, you don't get transformation. But you put in a little bit of V-SARC, you get oncogenic transformation. You start to put mutations back in, oncogenic transformation. All right? If you took C-SARC and you truncated this 3' end, or you changed that tyrosine to a phenylalanine, okay, oncogenic transformation. So, let me introduce a couple things first. Number one, what was also found at the same time is that this blue domain in SARC was found to be a tyrosine kinase. Now, starting in the late 1950s, we knew about protein kinases. It's very well described. This protein kinase phosphorylase domain, cascade, was described in the late 50s and early 60s in regards to control of signaling pathways. But that was, those were serine threonine kinases. A tyrosine kinase is a kinase that puts a phosphate on a tyrosine residue. There was argument for many, many years whether there was such a real enzyme or not, whether it really existed, or that was some sort of artifact in the laboratory. But it turns out it's a real enzyme. So now you have this tyrosine kinase, and what was noticed is if you put in C-SARC, as I said, even 50-fold more, that kinase activity wasn't sufficient to give you oncogenic transformation. But if you put in a little bit of V-SARC, which had way higher kinase activity, that was sufficient. All right? And again, if you made any of these mutations, truncated this end, tyrosine to phenylalanine, point mutations, now you get higher kinase activity. So kinase activity was connected with, the amount of kinase activity was connected with ability to transform cells. Everybody got that? All right. So There's a little bit more to it than that, but that's probably the basic idea, that here was this gene that had gotten transduced into a virus. Transduction was well known in bacterial viruses, and again, many of you may have studied the lactose operon. You know, that was again Jacob and Monod, that was in the early 60s. This was all well known in bacteria, of how these things could be transduced by a virus and now pass from one bacteria to the next. In other words, stolen from the host bacterial genome. So they figured that must be going on in these viruses and so on. They still didn't know the issue about the retrovirus and how that started and so on and so forth. But somehow it picked up this gene, and here's the main point that I want to give to you. This virus doesn't need this gene to replicate. I just mentioned that before. And therefore, if mutations occur in that extra gene, it doesn't bother the virus, it still can replicate. If you mutate that pollen end, you may mess up replication. And it turns out that the polymerase, so I'm not going to give you a virus lecture, that's maybe for a different time, but retroviruses start as RNA. Their polymerase is what's called a reverse transcriptase. It makes DNA from RNA. It was so difficult for the molecular biologists to figure this thing out at the time or to get their head around it, they actually had to call it a reverse transcriptase. Going against the dogma of DNA-RNA protein, this was going RNA-DNA. From that DNA copy, which was called a provirus, that provirus was inserting into the host genome, okay, and then just making more RNA, and that RNA encoded GAG pollen end, and in this case SARP, and now just made more virus. All right. The reverse transcriptase from these viruses is very error-prone. Makes a lot of mistakes. But if it made mistakes in SARP, the virus wouldn't care. So what ends up happening is, here you have this mutated SARP, a virus vector to get to the next cell or next chicken. And because of some of these mutations, now the tyrosine kinase activity is really, really high, and that's now causing transformation. That was the connection. And here's the actual picture of what it looked like. So what's been actually worked out is that when this tyrosine 527 is phosphorylated on tyrosine, the kinase is in a closed domain and it is not very strong kinase. So that's the normal situation with CSAR. If you truncate this C-terminal end, or you dephosphorylate it, or you mutate it, then this can be open. And when it's open, the kinase is more active, and the first thing it does is it autophosphorylates on tyrosine 416, and now you get more activity. And so in VSAR, since you don't have that tyrosine at all, this is constitutively activated. Very high kinase activity. All right. So that's just a proto-oncogene. I'm putting a lot of time here because it's one example. I'll give you a couple more examples, but one example of a theme about how mutations can lead to the taking what is a normal gene in your cell and now increasing its oncogenic potential through mutations. So here's the concept that CSARP, if it's mutated, you have this mutant SARP, or VSARP, which comes already mutated, and now you go from the monolayer of cells to these foci, which look like little tumors of cells growing on top of each other in culture. And of course, if you injected this into a chicken, you would get a tumor. And again, this is just a broad overview. You know, anytime you put up these pathways, even though it looks complicated, this is way simplistic based on what we know. But SARP is a major player downstream of integrins, which are signaling from cell adhesion, cell-to-cell interaction, cell-to-extracellular matrix interaction, or receptor tyrosine kinases, which are often growth factor receptors. They activate SARP, and now you have all sorts of pathways involved with survival, angiogenesis, proliferation, so for example, activating the famous RAS, RAF, MEK, ERK pathway, and then other players that are cytoskeleton or structural proteins and some other signaling proteins which are involved with affecting cell migration, chemotaxis, invasiveness, and things like that. So if this is on constitutively, all these guys are so heavily activated, now you have a cell that proliferates too much, that can invade too much, and so on and so forth. Survive or shouldn't survive. That's a simplistic point of view. All right. That's the only time I did that, I swear. So this is just a small list of what were oncogenes that were discovered in these oncoviruses, okay? And for example, PDGF, everybody knows about PDGF, platelet-derived growth factor, it was first identified in a retrovirus as the oncogene cis, okay? So if a cell is making way too much platelet-derived growth factor, now you're making the cell proliferate too much, eventually other things happen, you get cancer. You know, MYC, you have all sorts of MYCs, receptors that you probably know about, EGF receptor, CSF receptor, which is involved in macrophages, and so on and so forth. And here are a lot of the ones that we just talked about before. Even transcription factors, FOS, JUN, MYC, as I just mentioned, VOG, all these things were first identified as oncogenes in retroviruses. And as I'm telling you, this is not a full list. The list is probably about 120 genes. So let's talk about the three major mechanisms that a gene can be changed so that it might become oncogenically activated. So let me start by saying the following. These genes were identified in these oncoviruses, these retroviruses, in the animal kingdom. In the 1960s, there was a massive, what probably was about $1.5 billion in a decade, that was a lot of money, to hunt for what could have been human retroviruses that were causing cancer by transferring oncogenes from one person to the other. And it's been looked at, there are none. Okay? So now people have been studying this for decades. There are no such oncoviruses that transfer from man to man. Okay? So this stopped in the animal kingdom. But what we learned about the oncogenes that chickens have and that cows have and dogs have and from all these other oncoviruses is that we have orthologs, we have similar family genes, we have a SARC gene, which in fact is almost exactly the same sequence as chicken SARC. So we have just about the same number of these oncogenes as were identified in the viruses, but we don't have the viruses that are transferring them from human to human. But from the mechanisms of what I'm going to show you here, what we learned from what could activate these oncogenes genetically, we now can look at our genomes and say, are the same mutations happening in our genomes? And are those sufficient to give cancer? Okay? Very big point. We do not have these viruses transferring these things, but we do have the ability to have mutated oncogenes. Let's talk about that. So point mutations. So, again, in many of the list of those oncogenes, so, again, let me stress, not every gene can be an oncogene. It may be about 120 genes that we have, but they have to be changed exactly the right way in order for them to gain their oncogenic potential. So, RAS, as we'll talk about, also gets mutated, so many more, that if their normal versions get mutated and mutations in the right area of that gene product can now be constitutively activated. Instead of doing some sort of pathway in a controlled way, it's now turning that pathway on all the time, and that's pro-cancerous. Gene amplification. So if you have more copies of that gene, so it either could be at the genetic level, that is to say, amplification of the actual genes in the chromosome, or you could get overexpression, that is to say, same copy number, in other words, we have two copies of the genes, but for some reason you get really high amounts of RNA, then that could be pro-oncogenic. A good example of that we'll talk about is MYC. MYC doesn't get mutated, it just gets overexpressed. And then more combinations of mutations that we call translocations, fusions, inversions, all the other mutations you probably learned about in some biology class at college, where, you know, beside a point mutation, you have larger things like, you know, fusion between one chromosome and another, translocation of this part of the gene over there, flipping, so on and so forth. So when you finally get to the product of those mutated genes that way, translocation, that now can give you a truncated product, a fused product, and so on and so forth. And those things now can gain new activities, new locations in the cell, and new abilities to be growth regulated, by the way. They may now be turned on because they're downstream of a new promoter and they're turned on by something new. So all those things are possible. Okay. So again, you start with this proto-oncogene, and now let's get back to the definition of proto-oncogene. Proto-oncogene is really our normal gene, but it's of that group of genes that if they're messed up in 1, 2, or 3, can lead to their becoming oncogenes. Right? So it's before an oncogene, proto. Or you have point mutation, gene amplification, and these things like translocation, transposition, inversions, and so on. Okay. What I didn't say at the top here is that these things are all gain of function. Gain of function. All you need is one of these things. What do I mean? We have, except for sex chromosome genes in a male, where you have X and Y, everything else is two copies of, normally. So, in this case, if you mess up one in this way, it's dominant. All you need is one activated copy of RAS, and that's all you need. You don't have to have both. Okay? Alright, so let's go, and again, this is just a real bird's eye view. We're not going to be comprehensive. I'm just giving you a taste of these things. Mutations. There happen to be three RAS family genes in humans, H, K, and N RAS, EGF receptor, epidermal growth factor receptor. Again, a lot of these names are historical. It's not just for epidermal cells. It's for just about all cells have EGF receptor to some extent. Of course, if you have more receptor and there's plenty of the ligand, EGF, that can be pro-cancerous because you're making the cell proliferate too much. Gene amplification, here's some examples where no mutation is involved, but if you get more copies of them, so MYC is a cell cycle regulating transcription factor, again, more cell cycle. ERBB2, HER2, you may know, it's amplified in some types of breast tumor, and that's a receptor for growth factors, again, more proliferation. And then chromosomal translocation. So let's start with BCR-ABL. BCR-ABL is where you actually get BCR, one gene, and ABL, another gene, fusing, and the fusion product is oncogenic. BCR alone and ABL alone or not. Alright? That's one. And MYC, as a translocation, again, the MYC itself is not changed, but if MYC, the MYC gene locus translocates somewhere else where there's a strong promoter, that's making more MYC. Okay, that makes sense. And that happens. Especially in leukemias and so on. And some lymphomas. Okay. So let's switch gears just for a second about tumor suppressors. So simply put, tumor suppressors are things that should work in the opposite way. And again, Bob Weinberg was really the father of a lot of this. And they found this originally, this is already years later after the oncoviruses. And so by then, cell transfection methods, that is to say, you could purify DNA from one cell and now introduce it chemically into another cell. At the time, it used to be done with calcium phosphate precipitate. Now, any of you who are in the lab know what you do with these liposomes. It's easier and cheaper. But this is what they thought. They said, let's take DNA from this T24 bladder cancer. Nasty cancer cell line. Very, very aggressive. Let's take that guy, take the DNA from it, and we'll transfect it into these normal NIH3T3 cells. So these are mouse cells that have been immortalized, and they're very nice cells, and they make a monolayer, they transfect pretty well. Okay. And then we culture them, and we get one of those, you see that red thing in the middle is supposed to be that focus, that, like tumor-like structure. If we get one of those, let's pick that. Let's take the DNA out from that, because maybe it's obtained the oncogene that caused the bladder cancer. Let's take that focus DNA, purify it, retransfect it, and now see if we can, sort of winnow down the DNA so that we can identify now what is the human gene of origin in the background of mouse DNA. That was the oncogene. Not a bad experiment. Took Mitch Goldfarb, who was a student, 2.5 years to do this experiment. What did they get? They got a gene that was already known in the retrovirus world as the RAS oncogene. Okay? And what was the problem? That at codon 12, which was normally a glycine, GGC, a single base mutation was now giving you GTC, which gave you a valine. That's it. One point mutation was now giving you oncogenic RAS versus the normal RAS, the proto-oncogene RAS. And that mutation, by the way, was known in the rhabdomyosarcoma virus that where the RAS oncogene was isolated. Right? So they found from human bladder cancer, naively, no virus, they found this oncogene. Rediscovered in the second wave, right? And we now know, so that was from HRAS, again, remember there's three RAS alleles, this happened to be HRAS in bladder cancer, and we now know, if you look at it, I'll show you a little bit more, that many, many cancers in humans, like pancreatic and lung cancer, have a similar mutation in a similar site in the KRAS allele. And it's also oncogenically active. So that's now residue 12. You could also have mutations in residue 13, single point mutations, and residue 61. Right? And any of those single point mutations are oncogenically active. Now, if you had a mutation somewhere else in amino acid 82, nothing. So this also says that the mutation has to be in a specific functional domain. All right, so let's talk about that. So what does RAS do for a living? RAS is what's called a GTPase. This is an enzyme that converts GDP into GTP, and then now hydrolyzes it, so it gets rid of that phosphate. And now this is an energy-producing, again, a simplified thing, an energy-producing reaction locally. And this might drive some sort of cellular function, wherever RAS might be. Okay, so the active form of RAS is the GTP-bound form of RAS, right? And if you hydrolyze this GTP, in other words, get rid of that last phosphate, so it becomes GDP, you lose a lot of RAS activity. Right? So it's a cycle. If you have that G12V mutation that I just showed you, this is constitutively on. Basically, you have RAS GTP stuck in that active form. And whatever pathways downstream, which we'll talk about, is going gangbusters. All right, so, it goes from when it's mutated, it's G12V, now it's doesn't cycle. Okay. So again, simplistic point of view, what does RAS do? RAS is activating all sorts of second messengers, including pathway we talked about before, this RAF, MEK, ERK. ERK is another name for MAP kinase, and is turning on proliferation genes, so you have cell cycle progression, transcriptional control. You can go through PI3 kinase AKT pathway, very famous, that's involved with cell survival, cell growth, migration, more cell cycle progression. Things like endocytosis, so that moving material, including receptors from inside the cell to the surface, so all this activity. other things that control the cytoskeleton and cell migration, calcium signaling, again, which is going to be active in some of the reaction pathways, more in the cytosis here, able. Okay? So this is just a simple cross-section of what RAS might do. And if all these things are on full tilt, you could imagine how the cell is now marked for more oncogenic transformation because it's proliferating too much, or it's now migrating too much, or invading too much, or things like that. In other words, acting like a cancer cell. So what I want to point out to you is there are proteins, and really dozens of these things. I'm just giving you some examples. So there are so-called GAP proteins, that's activating proteins, that now facilitate this turnover of GTP to GDP. Here's some names of some of them. We'll talk about NF1 in a second. And then there are some which are GEF, which are exchange factors, which facilitate the GDP to become the active form. Okay? So you could imagine that even if RAS is oncogenically activated by mutation, you could also have compensatory things by either the GAPs or the GEFs, by either there being more of them, less of them, mutated versions, etc., which can modify the oncogenic potential of this. In other words, just because you have a mutation on RAS, that's not the end of the story. You really have to know the whole neighborhood here. Very complicated. All right. Here's just an example of the RASs in human cancer. So pancreatic cancer is really KRAS driven. Over 90% have the mutations I described to you before in KRAS. Therefore, KRAS is causes, no question about it. And by the way, the other percentage are probably not even the so-called normal adenocarcinoma pancreatic cancer. They're probably these rarer so-called neuroendocrine, everybody calls it now the Steve Jobs pancreatic cancer, where people can probably live for 9-10 years before it becomes aggressive. It's a totally different biology. So you start to go down the line, you can see, you know, large percentages of all sorts of cancers where you have different types of RASs that are mutated. Again, lung, about a third, and that is clearly a driver in those third cases of lung cancers, non-small cell lung cancer. All right. So RAS alone is a massive driver of many of these cancers. All right, let's change gears a little bit and talk about some of the fusion oncogenes. All right, so the prototype one for that is BCR-ABL, well understood. I hope you can see this at the bottom, but it's just a cartoon. So ABL happens to be on chromosome 9, BCR happens to be on chromosome 22. This was well known in the 1960s that if you looked at certain types of chronic myelogenous leukemias, they were marked by a very interesting chromosomal translocation, which was called Philadelphia chromosome, because it was identified first in Philadelphia. And later, when they were able to have chromosome-specific probes, they figured out that part of chromosome 9 had fused with part of chromosome 22, and you got this fusion chromosome. And later, it was found that from 22, you got about half of BCR gene, and from 9, you got about the other half of ABL, and so now you made this fusion oncogene. ABL happens to be a tyrosine kinase, just like SARC. And BCR is involved with many things. But sufficient to say, this fusion oncogene is now bringing ABL to a different part of the cell. It's bringing it to where BCR normally acts, where not where ABL normally acts. So the fusion oncogene does two things. It makes Abel's tyrosine kinase activity constitutive, high tyrosine kinase activity. We heard that from SARP. When you get that, that's oncogenic. Plus, if you bring this protein to a different part of the cell, you start to have abnormal signaling. You put those two things together, and you start to have new signaling pathways, which are, again, proliferation that we know about, reduced apoptosis, the cell survives longer, okay? You have genome instability. Abel's involved with a very, very interesting pathway of normally controlling genome stability. So now you have more instability, more mutations, more plasticity in this tumor cell, it can become more malignant. Cytoskeletal abnormalities, when you have cytoskeletal abnormalities, the cell has more ability to be motile or invasive, and so on and so forth. Okay, so this is found in a large percentage, I can't tell you the exact number, but it's close to 90% of chronic myelogenous leukemia. And prior to, let's say, 15 years ago, that disease, which happens very often in young adults, was a very low survival after 3 years. But a bunch of groups got together and they started to develop inhibitors. It was first called STI-571, it's now called Gleevec. So a drug that would inhibit not ABL alone, only the BCR-ABL combination. Okay, specific for this fusion oncogene. And Gleevec is that drug. So Gleevec is a great example of a targeted, almost one of the first examples of targeted therapies based on the genetics of that person's cancer. So-called personalized therapy. And that drug turned chronic myelogenous leukemia from really a fatal disease to almost 100% survival after 3 years. Changed everything. Now, you get subsequent mutations in ABL so that Gleevec no longer works, but there are second, third line related drugs which are now being used to treat these things. But it just gave us an idea about drivers, which are oncogenically inducing the cancer, and also, here's the most important part, they're the targets. So all the stuff that we talk about in cancer genomics and personalized medicine, it's not just for aficionado business of saying you have this and I have that. It's so that we can identify what might be the driver mutations that are targetable therapeutically. Yeah?
Could you use CRISPR-Cas to cut these out of the tumor cells, for example?
Yes, in a bunch of cells in a dish. But how could you do that purely efficiently in a person? First of all, you're not allowed to do CRISPR-Cas in a person right now. Right, but even if you could, you'd have to do it in every single one of their cells. And chemotherapy right now is clearly the better way to do it. And CRISPR-Cas wasn't around 15 years ago. But it's a good idea. Okay? So, does everybody know about CRISPR-Cas? Okay. You will at some point. Alright, so here's others. Just, you know, the same thing. PAX8, PPAR, gamma. PAX8 is a transcription factor, so now, all of a sudden, this transcription factor, because of PPAR, has new targets, new gene targets, which now give the tumor cell a new biology. But this can be targeted. AML1, also a transcription factor. This happens to be in leukemia. So this was the old way. I don't want to, if Dr. Block is here, she'll scream at me, but she trained on this, you know, she still does this, these so-called translocations where you could actually look at the chromosome and you would identify these specific, so this is a translocation of chromosome 2 to 21, parts of the short end of 11 to the short end of 22. Those things were described in the pathology report, and in many cases that described what treatment you would use at the time. But they didn't quite know why they were being helpful. Now we know the exact fusion that's happening and what the biology is about that fusion. Again, these are fusions to transcription factors which give them broadened activity. Okay. So here's another theme about large mutations in genes that can give you oncogenes, truncations. So here's, again, a very naive cartoon about how a growth factor receptor might work. Many of the growth factor receptors are kinases themselves, and their kinase domains are inside the cell, whereas on the outside of the cell, they have a ligand binding domain. Here she's showing you tyrosine kinase, but they could be serine and threonine kinase. So the notion is that when the ligand comes, EGF, it binds and multimerizes several of the growth factor receptors. And when you get multimerization, you actually can bring the kinase domains together, close enough together on the intracellular part, so that they can cross-phosphorylate each other. There's probably some conformational changes which activate the internal kinase domains, and they phosphorylate each other, and now they become active and they can start signaling some molecules. When they phosphorylate each other, again, you're going to see these P's or phosphates, you're going to learn about signaling. I actually may even be giving that lecture. You may be learning about signaling cascades, and one of the things that happens are proteins that bind to these phosphodomain parts. So before they were phosphorylated, the other proteins wouldn't bind. But now, once those guys are phosphorylated, now they're recognized by domains of these other proteins, and that's how you bring these next players in the cascade to have signal transduction. And eventually you get gene transcription, proliferation, blah, 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 all these other things that happen. So what can happen oncogenically? And that is that if you have mutations that delete the extracellular domain of that gene, you may end up having one of two things, that you could get multimerization of the receptor without the need for ligand, and you already get activation. So it becomes ligand, keep doing it, ligand-independent activation, and they're on all the time. Okay? So here's on, it's phosphorylated even without ligand. You could even have this without having to have big mutations. You could have small mutations, or even in small deletions, or even point mutations, which do the same thing. Ligand no longer binds, and yet it's now constitutively activated with its kinase domain. Right? So that's another thing that happens, typically with growth factor receptors. Okay, so let's go back to the oncogene amplification story, things like MYC and HER2. This picture here, these are individual cell nuclei, and this is something called fluorescence in situ hybridization, FISH. So normally, if you treat these cells in such a way so that their chromosomes condense, so it's before they condense, but the nucleus is sort of frozen with fixation, so again, in a normal cell, you should have two copies of every gene. If you had a probe for gene X, in this case, CMYC, okay? Sorry, not CMYC, this is part of the 8q chromosome. So CMYC happens to be on 8q24. That's address on chromosome 8, where CMYC actually is. But if you now take another piece of DNA, which is telomeric, which is upstream from CMYC, doesn't have CMYC in it, now you take that DNA and you label it with a red fluorescence. And you now stain these cells. If you look carefully, you should see two dots, two red dots. You see those? Because you have two copies of that gene, you know, two chromosomes, right? Here's a red dot, here's a red dot. Here's a red dot, here's a red dot. One, and there's another one with hardness obscured right there. Okay? That's normal. And you could play that game all the time with a normal gene that's not amplified. But if you take a probe for CMYC and label it with green, look how many copies. Okay? Hundreds of copies. Scores. That's amplification. And so we still do at Roswell, again, Dr. Block is heading that laboratory, where we still do, for some of the assays, this fish assay for things that are known to be amplified. It's a relatively quick thing, sort of, you know, cookbook. And now we can say, oh, MYC was amplified in that tumor, in that leukemia lymphoma. And that's important. Why? Because here's some examples of a cancer where if you had fewer than 10 copies of MYC, that's already still amplified. You should only have two. This is survival. Okay? Here, we're at years. You're still pretty good. But if you have greater than 10 copies, that's bad. You're not going to survive. All right? Again, suggesting that more copies of MYC is the driver. Yeah. Yeah, that would take a lecture, but it can be very discrete areas of the chromosome that during S phase, when you are replicating the chromosome, certain areas are subject to effectively the DNA replication machinery goes back. And the reason why that doesn't normally happen is that there are very specific factors. Again, that's you'll get this in the DNA replication lectures, things called licensing factors, so that things are done, some people call them ticketing factors, licensing factors. It's akin to these proteins saying, I stamped your ticket in the concert, and if you're trying to get in again, or give it to someone else to get it, they go, look, I stamped it already, so you can't go in again. So you can only go once. That's what those proteins do. But in the absence of some of those proteins, there are areas which then get copied and copied and copied at the DNA level. And then they get concatemerized at the DNA, so there's many copies. And some of them hop to other chromosomes because there's so many made. And some of them actually make their own little mini satellite chromosomes. Okay? There's so many copies that they make these little things that are called, you know, they're like mini chromosomes. So there's many, many different mechanisms. It's a whole complicated thing, but it happens. And again, as cancer gets worse and you lose the ability to fix things, repair, because you're breaking through the checkpoints in the cell cycle, which are normally there to fix things, you retain more and more mistakes. Okay? Okay, so here's HER2-NU. So if you have no amplification of HER2-NU in breast cancer, here's your survival over, doesn't say it, but these are years also. If you have more than 5 copies, a worse prognosis. Okay? So it's pretty straightforward. So here I'm just showing you lists of frequently amplified genes, you know. By the way, beside MYC, RASs can have that too. Growth factor receptors, here's FGF receptor 1, PI3 kinase, which is part of that pathway I showed you before. So a lot of these things make sense. Cyclins, so cyclins are part of the cell cycle, you know, cyclin E probably is mostly involved with G1 to S transition for proliferation. Okay, so all these things make sense that if you have too many copies, then they're pro-cancers. And again, I'm going to give, this is a list and it's not a full list, but it's giving you, like, you know, a real great idea of the functions of these things that can act as oncogenes, how they, it's not saying how they're, in some cases it says fusion proteins, only get fusion. In some cases you don't know, but they may be mutations or overexpression. But these could be eventually made into oncogenic genes. This is what their function is. Here's the tyrosine kinase, here's the transcription factor. And here are at least some of the cancers that they're involved with. And that's one of them, and that's the second. And all these are required for the exam. Oh, God. I'm glad you're joking. All right. No. Anyway, but just for you to get, and again, I'm telling you that this is not even a full list. But the point is, it's not every gene. It's some genes. And some of them are just obvious, you know, what they do. We talk about RASs and so on and so forth, and transcription factors. All right. So everybody has that. That's the. Now, this is, I think, a nice graph because it shows you that even though I showed you before that pancreatic cancer is associated with 90% of pancreatic cancer has mutations, oncogenic mutations in KRAS. That's not, so here's KRAS. And pancreatic is, oh my God, that's going to be hard to see, but that's right there, that big skyscraper right there. You see that? Okay. But I think that's it. Yeah, KRAS. Okay? But you can see KRAS. Look how many cancers it's either a small player or a large player in. And I think the point to show is that depending on any of these things as oncogenes, you know, you can find them more or less in different cancers. So this gave rise in the last certainly 10 years, you know, for many, many years, decades, cancer treatment was based on organ, even when it was a metastatic version of the cancer. We've rethought that. Because if the driver for this melanoma is BRAF, and for this, these colorectal cancers, not all, but just those colorectal cancers, is mutated BRAF, then they should be treated the same way. So normally you'd send one guy to the colon specialist, the other guy to the dermatologist, right? Now we say, wait a minute, we do the genetic testing, we say, actually the treatment for both those groups who have BRAF mutations is the same treatment. We have nice BRAF inhibitors right now, clinical. Okay? So the change is about personalized medicine. It doesn't matter where it came from, it matters what the oncogenic drivers are. And here's a sort of a landscape already. All right. So let's talk a little bit more about, and finish off here about, about oncogenes versus tumor suppressors. So in the beginning when they were trying to find tumor suppressors, what I didn't show you were some of the experiments that were done to actually say that there's such a thing as a tumor suppressor. I mean, you can sort of say it, you just put it by watching Star Trek, and you go, there's matter, antimatter, but that doesn't help. You have to be able to show some experimental data. So here you have a cancer cell, here you have a normal cell, and if you fuse that together, which should be dominant? Now, remember, it was already known at the time that I told you that oncogenes are dominant. All you need is one mutated version of the oncogene, the other guy's normal. So shouldn't the fusion cell now be cancerous? It's not. Fusion cell is not cancerous. That means the normal cell had a suppressor of the tumor oncogene. Okay? That was a very strong experiment. And there were several experiments done like that in the late 70s. Okay. And this really gave rise to the concept that there were tumor suppressor genes. So let me get a little bit more into the tumor suppressor issue about the difference between familial and sporadic. Familial, as it sounds, are things that are passed down from in the germline genome. Every single copy of that person's DNA would have it, all right? And if they get it, and for example, not for example, so. Oh, assuming that tumor suppressors are recessive, that means in order to lose their function, you have to lose both functions. Not just one, both functions. So why did the fusion cell win, the normal cell win? Because they had two tumor suppressors, and the tumor cell had one oncogene. Two gets one. That's simplistic, but that's probably true. Now, if you have familial mutations in a tumor suppressor. So person X has one copy of their tumor suppressor mutated that they just have inherited in all their cells. And they now make a baby with someone else who has also a single mutation. It becomes Mendelian. 25% will have, of the offspring will have both of those copies mutated. Of course, it has to be specific mutations that are the deleterious mutations, not just any mutation. Alright? So that's where this notion that Alfred Knudsen, who just passed away actually, came up with this two-hit hypothesis that just losing one tumor suppressor is not sufficient. You need to have the second tumor suppressor lost, or the second function lost. And, okay, so here you have... So, how is that known? Because if these people have familial mutations, one is mutated, all they need to have is a second one of their second gene spontaneously mutate, that's a single event, and now you get two hits. Whereas in the sporadic, where it happens less frequency, you have to have two independent events, one in one allele and one in the other allele. And that's why this happens very infrequently, whereas this is absolute Mendelian genetics. Okay? All right.
This is both oncogenes and tumor suppressors.
Say again?
Both oncogenes and tumor suppressors follow the two-hit hypothesis.
Right. So originally, Alfred Knudsen developed his two-hit hypothesis really just for tumor suppressors. But it turns out to be true. That's a very good question. So if you just had a single allele of RAS that was mutated, I could actually show you data. You could make a transgenic mouse where every single cell has mutated RAS, no cancer occurs. Okay? Maybe when they're like 2 years old, they start to get some cancers, but that's fine. But they get some hyperplasias, they get some other things, but all benign. You need a second hit, and the second hit would be activation of another oncogene or loss of a relevant tumor suppressor. So that's where the two-hit hypothesis got expanded, but his original point was coming from comparing familial cases of what turned out to be tumor suppressor loss versus sporadic. Okay? All right, so with tumor suppressor functions, direct inactivating mutations, it's rare because, you know, mutations do not get sustained that much, and again, a mutation just can't be anywhere, it has to be in the right place. You have to hit both alleles, that's even more rare. Okay? Now, mutations during mitosis. So imagine you go back to the familial case, so that person has lost one function, one of their functions by, you know, the inherited mutation. If they lost that other function, that's called loss of heterozygosity. You're going to hear that a lot, LOH. That means that second allele could have a point mutation, it could have a deletion, it could have a translocation, but you've lost that second function. So you're no longer heterozygote anymore for that. You are now totally lost of the two alleles. So LOH is a big thing that happens in cancer. It can happen spontaneously, it's still pretty rare in the sporadic, but in the it happens more frequently in the familial. Okay? Alright, let me skip this because this is the same thing I just said. So here's an example where we're talking about it with the retinoblastoma gene. Retinoblastoma is a relatively rare cancer it's in the eye, in the retina, of newborns. So they're several months old and they develop these tumors. There's nothing you can do except remove the eye. It is not invasive, it's not anything else, but it is a source of serious blindness for these kids. They are often born with one mutation because it's inherited, it's usually inherited. And now that person is having a baby with someone else who has this, you know, another mutation, and then you have the chance of getting, you know, so either a second mutation in that same person, that's rare. Here's mitotic crossover where you could get part of the same chromosome, that's also rare, that's a reassortment of the chromosomes, and now you've lost the normal part, okay, you see that? And now you have two bad copies. These are all rare events. But if you had two people married who had mutations, it's purely Mendelian. Alright, I think I've... Alright. So, now let's talk about the last area in tumor suppressor gene loss of function, and that is epigenetic silencing. So this is mostly identified as promoter hypermethylation. So let's go over that a little bit. So everyone should know what a promoter of a gene is. It's basically the area of a gene, certainly upstream of where the gene starts. So this is where the RNA would recognize, RNA polymerase, excuse me, would start making RNA. That's how we know there's a gene there. If there's no RNA made, there's no gene. That's the definition of a gene. All right? And so typically, upstream of here are sequences, you know, can be close, can be several kilobases upstream. Sometimes they even go into the first exon or intron area. So that sort of general transcriptional start site area. And there are sequences that transcription factors can bind to, and some of those transcription factors are activating transcription, or repressing transcription, or, you know, pausing transcription, all these other things. If you have a gene that is being expressed, but now happens to have in its promoter, many genes have what are called CpG islands. That is the sequence C next to a G. CpG islands are methylated by a host of enzymes that we have. The most popular ones are these DNMT 1, 2, 3. They can methylate the C in this configuration. And it's called islands because you don't have just one CpG, you have a whole bunch of them together. Alright? So let me just start a little bit beforehand. What ends up happening is, if the cell wants to turn this gene off, for example, if it's a tumor suppressor gene that is preventing a cell from moving forward to becoming a cancer cell, let's say RAS has become mutated, but there's a very active production of tumor suppressor mRNA and protein, you could select for the cell which turns this RNA off. All right? So you could downregulate the transcription factors, you could phosphorylate them. You know, if this was the SARC oncogene that was activated, actually it's been shown that SARC can phosphorylate some of the transcription factors and inactivate them. So you turn off expression of this mRNA for the tumor suppressor, and then the cell wants to keep that down. So what it does is it now upregulates the methylation enzyme, so it methylates these CpG islands upstream, and then there are HDACs, so these are histone deacetylase protein complexes. Of course, chromatin is written in a complicated array of different types of chromatin, which are marked with different modifications. So these HDAC protein complexes especially recognize methylated CpG. They can remove histone acetylations, which are usually involved with active chromatin, and now that those areas of chromatin become closed, transcription closed, and so this turned off gene now stays off in the tumor cell. So the way we could recognize that very easily is by taking a look at a tumor cell, showing that it's lost a tumor suppressor. We don't see the RNA or the protein, but if you look at the DNA, it's totally fine, no mutations, right? Not even a mutation in the promoter. You can get a mutation in the promoter which affects expression. No, totally normal, but it's turned off. And you'll then typically find that the promoter has been hypermethylated to keep it down, all right, how are we doing on time? Ooh, we gotta go. So a couple more just to sort of bring these things up again. We talked about the RAS cycle, activation, deactivation, and so on. NF1 is one of the gap proteins that we talked about before, which facilitates deactivation of RAS. Okay? But there are mutations in neurofibromatosis, which inactivate this NF1 gene, and it's a tumor suppressor. And when you inactivate that, that functionally mimics hyperactivation of RAS, that is to say mutated RAS. So this is off, this part is off, and now you're staying the active, even though RAS is not mutated. So neurofibromatosis mutation is typically known in the elephant man, if you saw the movie. It's this very large growth, is relatively benign, but there are massive hyperplasias there's still neoplastic of neuromuscular type of tissues, including skeletal tissues and so on. But it's cancer. All right. And again, just a list of lots of tumor suppressors, and I give you some of the familial cancer syndromes where they're lost, like lining is lost, and they're spread by in the typical Mendelian fashion, and then the types of cancers where you see them sporadically, and again, the functions that they have. RBP53 big players, so you may have heard of Lee Fromme syndrome. These are families that have mutations in P53. They don't get specific types of cancers, but they get high rates of all types of cancers, both solid cancers and sort of liquid cancers like leukemias. P10, so there's a disease called Cowden's disease, which actually, amongst other things, has high rates of spontaneous cancer. But then we know that the loss of this gene, by one way or another, is plays a big role in glioblastoma, prostate, breast, and so on. And that's because P10 is a natural antagonist, a suppressor of PI3 kinase AKT signaling. You take that away, and now AKT is hyperactivated. All right. And just one last slide. This is the last slide. Just to remind you that in the beginning, when people were trying to find these things, and the bottom line for this is keep an open mind. P53, which is literally one of the biggest tumor suppressors around, and mutated in probably half of cancers, or transcription lost, was originally thought to be an oncogene. Why was it thought to be an oncogene? Because SP40, which was a virus, simian virus 40, could oncogenically transform cells. And what was found is that there was a protein called, that was 53 kilodaltons, protein 53, P53, that bound to the major inducer from SP40 called T antigen, major inducer of the oncogenic transformation. So it was thought that if this guy is binding to a cellular protein, that must be an oncogene. Right? But then, what it turns out is, with subsequent experiments, which really took many, many, many years to disprove this, that it's an oncogene, that ultimately what SP40T antigen does is exactly causes cancer by binding to P53 and RB and degrading them. Right? So it's actually killing those proteins. In the beginning, they found it bound because that's what they were looking for. So when they put the sort of experimental blinders on, you go, oh, look, we found it binding to SP40T antigen, it must be an oncogene. But they didn't think of the whole consequences. And it turns out it does bind, but it degrades them and does just the opposite of what we thought. So these really are tumor suppressors. All right. There you have it. This is the genetic changes, oncogenes, amplification, insertion, so that you get more expression like MYC. Activating mutations, fusion genes, tumor suppressors, you can get deletion, mutations that kill their function, loss of heterozygosity, and promoter hypermethylation. So all those are the themes that I want you to come away with. All right, any questions? 1 minute over. Okay. Have fun. Thank you.